From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the March 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Forging a Special Relationship. In March 1946, as an Iron Curtain was descending across Europe, in post-war London, a document was signed that to this day is the basis of the most important and longest intelligence relationship that the UK has. But that special relationship with the USA didn't suddenly begin 75 years ago. It was the culmination of 5 years of wartime collaboration. In this episode, podcast producer Mark Cotton and our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, go back to 1941 and look at each of the milestones that led up to the signing of the Yakuza Agreement. 5 years that forged a special relationship. Special thanks go to Stephen Eric Wilson and Mr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents. The reason for this episode, David, is because we've got a significant anniversary coming up, haven't we?
We have indeed. 5th of March this year will be the 75th anniversary of the so-called Yakuza Agreement, the UK-USA Agreement. And this is a very significant moment in the history of the UK-US intelligence sharing relationship.
But the story doesn't start there, does it? The story actually starts 5 years before that, with the famous visit of the first four American intelligence officers to Bletchley Park.
It does. We've just had the 80th anniversary of an incident that took place in 1941, on February the 8th, 1941, in fact, which was the so-called sink-off visit, where the first four Americans were able to visit Bletchley Park and were introduced to Enigma and the various other activities going on in GCNCS. And in exchange for that, they brought equipment connected to the US breaking of Japanese codes. And between those two anniversaries, if you like, between 1941 and 1946, you have a 5 year period of the developing relationship between the two countries. It was a rocky road at times. It took them 5 years to get themselves organized and to finally kind of trust and agree with one another. But the 5th of March 1946, 75 years ago, was the time when the agreement, which endures to this day, was finally hammered out and their ongoing relationship was finally settled.
And over the last 5 years of the podcast, we've looked at a number of these significant milestones. The first one, going back to when we celebrated the February 1941 visit, quite a strange day, wasn't it?
It was. It's interesting that I've been at Bletchley just over 6 years now, longer than it was open during the war, in fact. But I do remember the 8th of February 2016, very distinctly, because Admiral Rogers from the NSA happened to be in the UK, and the then director of GCHQ, Robert Hannigan, brought him to Bletchley. And it was all very cloak and dagger. They turned up in kind of blacked out 4x4s, and no one was told except a very small group of us that they were going to be here. And men in bulky raincoats kind of wandered about. But it was clear at the time just how much that first anniversary, the beginning of the relationship, if you like, meant both to GCHQ and to the NSA. And Admiral Rogers didn't stop grinning all day. It was great.
It definitely means a lot to them, doesn't it?
It does. And it also means a lot to Bletchley Park. It's become a feature of the tours that I give, that when we go into Denison's office now, I talk about the moment in 1941, but I also talk about the moment in 2016, because both things happened here, if you like. And certainly, as we work towards the 5th of March anniversary this year, it's clear that both GCHQ and NSA see the 1946 anniversary in exactly the same light, and they will be marking the occasion and celebrating the relationship. And we're definitely a part of that process because we're marking the anniversary as well and talking about 41, 46, and the 5 years in between.
We're going to go back to episode 43 and listen in on that historic visit from the heads of GCHQ and the NSA.
These are the gates that were the entrance to Bletchley Park during the Second World War. The UK SIGINT organisation, the Government Code and Cipher School, had moved here in August 1939 and by the middle of 1940 had started to make serious inroads, certainly into German Air Force Enigma traffic.
Yes, and the Americans who came here, I know, understood the importance of the building in their time, and I really appreciate the importance of it today. This is like the hometown for both American and British cryptologists.
Yeah. The reason, of course, for the Americans visiting here was that a series of decisions had been made by politicians in the UK and the US.
Yes.
That there should be a full exchange between the two countries on technical matters.
Yes.
Not just in intelligence, but also in things like radar, in advanced gunnery and things like that.
Yes.
And I think it's particularly important to remember that our relationship, the relationship between the SIGINT organizations of the two countries, was part of a much wider relationship.
Yes, but it had solid political support at the top. President Roosevelt had given the Americans authority to share it all, and we came prepared to share as much as we could with our new friends.
Indeed.
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. In the 1930s, the United States cryptologic services exploited Japanese diplomatic communications and were working without much success against Japanese Navy communications. While the United States cryptologic service was interested in all the Axis powers, they looked at German communications, they looked at Italian communications, it was pretty clear that if war came to the United States, it would be against Japan. So the service cryptologic agencies began dealing with Japanese communications. The Army had the greatest success in the 1930s. They solved Japanese diplomatic communications, which were enciphered by a sophisticated machine. The Americans, in addition to solving this Japanese crypto system, developed and devised a machine that could analyze these communications automatically. This device enabled the Americans to read Japanese diplomatic communications on a near real-time basis. The U.S. Army, in working against Japanese diplomatic communications, nicknamed those communications Purple. When they devised a machine for automatic solution of these communications, they called it the Purple Analog. In 1940, the United States was neutral. Most Americans hoped to stay out of the wars that were raging in Europe and Asia. The United States military was weak. It was small. It was ill-equipped. Most Americans did not envision going to war again the way they had in 1918. However, President Franklin Roosevelt recognized the United States was not going to be able to stay out of the war. We had to prepare ourselves militarily. We had to find allies. He sent envoys to the United Kingdom to find out not only that the British would never surrender to the Nazis, but that they did have the means to continue to resist. Once convinced of that, Roosevelt saw that it was in America's interest to support the British. The British were fighting America's fight, a fight we were not ready for. To this end, he authorized discussions between the military experts of the American Army and Navy with their equivalents in the British Army and Navy. During these conferences, which a number of agreements were reached about sharing bases or obsolete destroyers, a number of support measures that could be done immediately. In the midst of this, the American and British technical negotiators suggested, how about exchanging information about cryptology? This was a radical idea, and in the United States, it had to go straight to the president, who agreed that it was a good idea, that it was something we could share, something that would benefit both countries. In the United States Army and Navy, there were in each service small cryptologic units. They were numerically small, but the practitioners were highly professional. They were brilliant people. They developed new analytic techniques, both to protect American communications from enemy cryptanalysts and to solve enemy messages. It was in this context that two from the Army, two from the Navy, were selected to make contact with the British. Once the political agreements had been reached that allowed this to happen, these four Americans were chosen to travel to the United Kingdom and begin sharing to the extent determined by the relationship as it developed.
My name's Tony Comer. I'm the departmental historian at GCHQ. The irony, of course, is that once the decision had been taken to invite the American cryptanalysts to Bletchley Park, there was nothing really for the people at Bletchley Park to do other than sit and wait. All the arrangements for the travel were made by the Secret Intelligence Service, and all the people at Bletchley Park knew was that the Americans were due to travel on HMS King George V after it had dropped Lord Halifax in Washington to become the new British ambassador. You can imagine the problems that people had here at Bletchley, wondering when these people were ever going to arrive.
The Americans traveled in a British convoy across the Atlantic and were landed in Scapa Flow. The original plan was for the Americans to fly from the Orkneys down to London. However, the crates of cryptoanalytic devices that the Americans had brought would not fit in the designated airplanes, so they had to travel along the east coast of Britain by ship. While they were traveling, this ship was attacked by German aircraft. It was heavily strafed. In addition to the distress caused to the cryptologists, this had an interesting after effect. They were not the first, but they were among the first Americans to come under German fire. When they returned to the United States, not only could they share the cryptanalytic information that they exchanged with the British, but they could talk about the danger, about the urgency, about the threats to convoys as they had sailed across the ocean, and most chilling of all, of being under German air attack. They were landed in London. They were taken overland to Bletchley Park. They were tired. They were perhaps frightened. They were cold and a little bit wet, perhaps. But a warm welcome awaited them at Bletchley Park. They were among colleagues there.
I'm walking up the path towards the mansion at Bletchley Park. 75 years ago, on a cold February night, four Americans made this exact same approach to the house. They were here on a secret mission.
I was about to say colored pencils at the time. We still did sing at 30 years ago.
Here to mark the 75th anniversary of that visit are the current heads of the two countries' intelligence agencies, Robert Hannigan from GCHQ and Admiral Mike Rogers from the NSA. What was the significance of that visit during the war by the Americans here to Bletchley Park?
It was the birth of an incredibly close relationship at a time when Britain was facing defeat, many people thought, at the hands of the Axis powers. And that trust between the two leaders, between President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, was the core of meeting those threats.
America wasn't even in the war at that time, and each side a little concerned about the other, about, boy, this is really sensitive knowledge each of us has learned over time. Are we comfortable that we can truly share this? But at the time, I compliment them on both sides' willingness to take a chance.
It was a leap of trust.
We were driven through the night up to Bletchley.
Never heard before, this is Prescott Currier, one of the four Americans, recorded here in 1991 before he died, speaking about the visit and what the British revealed.
We went everywhere, including Hut 6. We watched the operation of the bomb. We were told and explained in great detail the solution of the Enigma, who worked on it, how the bomb worked, what they had to do in order to get a readable text.
At that time, it was the trauma of a global conflict and the fight against totalitarianism and Nazism. And yet we find ourselves 75 years later in a fight, in this case, counterterrorism, but a whole broader range of interests that have kept us together 75 years later in a way that today, Robert and I, as the current leaders of the SIGINT efforts for our respective nations, take for granted.
Is the relationship as close and as important now as it was then?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any doubt. I think each of us consider the other the strongest partner we have in the world.
No one can face this alone, and there is no closer relationship than we have, and it's the rock of our security.
Yeah. Yeah. Cold, overcast, gray. All we need is a slight drizzle.
That's all now. You got really. Great.
I'll let you get on with the rest of the
all right,
program. Great, but thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Dagrón, here we're standing in this famous place. What does it feel like to be here in Alistair Denison's office?
Well, first I am struck by just the significance of it. Who would think that the arrival of four U.S. military officers in February of 1941 would over time lead to the relationship that we now take for granted? And I think to myself back then, for those four individuals who showed up here that night, and as I think we've talked, it was almost midnight. They've arrived from a long transatlantic journey. They really don't understand much about Bletchley Park. They're going to learn more in the coming weeks. They don't necessarily have a full understanding of exactly why they're here. And yet, out of that grows this fundamental relationship that today we take for granted. And yet in their time, none of that existed. America wasn't even in the war at that point. It's just amazing to me.
Fantastic. And today, of course, we run Bletchley Park as a heritage attraction, encourage visitors from all over the world to come here and find out this story. What would you say to American tourists coming to UK about Bletchley Park?
I would first encourage you to come here because Bletchley Park represents an entwined history between our two nations. And it shows what our nations can do when we come together. And it also is a reminder to us that even as today we look at counterterrorism, cybersecurity, significant, massive problems, it's a good reminder to all of us that our respective nations have dealt with massive problems before. And when they work together as a team, even something like the Second World War, we can deal with this. That's a great reminder.
Thank you very much. Robert, clearly Bletchley Park is really where the name GCHQ started from. What does it feel like to be the director standing in this place today, commemorating this important event?
Well, it's a huge part of our history, as you say, and we're very proud of what happened here, proud of our staff, famous names like Alan Turing, but a lot of names who aren't famous who did incredible work alongside US and our colleagues during the war. So this is a huge part of our heritage. And standing in this room for me is a reminder it all comes back to people in the end. You know, brilliant, dedicated people, hardworking, working together, taking risks as we have between us. And that partnership, as Mike says, is something which nothing can destroy, and it can do fantastic things against threats today as it did 75 years ago.
Thank you very much, Sir John.
It's wonderful to hear what's being said there from the United States side and from the United Kingdom side. We have worked hard here at Bletchley Park to restore as far as we can the atmosphere and the original form and furniture and everything else of this office. And it's focused everybody's minds on the fact actually what happened here, that it was in this room that these people came, just the four of them, late in the evening on February the 8th, 1941. The secretary came in with the sherry. There wasn't any whiskey or gin available.
I'd like to state for the record, I have no sherry in this.
We don't do that now. And here they were, and they exchanged the most fundamental and important secrets and achievements at that time that either side had. And that does need to be understood. So the British side talked about the breaking of Enigma, and the US side talked about and handed over a machine relating to the breaking of Purple. These were the biggest secrets that we had, and in the United Kingdom's case, we're in the middle of an absolutely fundamental existential war. And that happened nearly a year before the United States joined the war, when we had no treaty obligations to each other at all, and we were not in any kind of formal partnership. That is telling you something about the nature of the relationship between the two countries and the two peoples. And it explains in a rather fundamental way why it has developed into the form that it takes today that my colleagues have described. This is where it happened. Come here, be here where it happened.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Really, it's great to see what you guys have done.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is such an important part of history, not just for our profession, and for intelligence professionals writ large, but for our respective nation, which is great.
to see this immortalized in a way that 20 years ago, I mean, this could have all been flattened. Absolutely. We would have all done something totally else. Nobody would have thought about it until the movie comes out, and then it would have been, wow, this, you know, that car park is weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this way you're not going to be like Richard III and wind up in a car
park. No, exactly. Right.
Now, the next milestone we've got is in 1943, isn't it?
Yes. There's an agreement in May of 1943, known as the Agreement between the British Government Code and Cipher School and the US War Department. And this was shortened to BRUSA for Britain, USA. This agreement really sets up the close relationship between Bletchley and the United States codebreaking agencies, because it's after BRUSA that the first US personnel start coming to Bletchley Park in any numbers. There have been a couple of short visits beforehand by sort of two, three, four people. But after BRUSA, you start getting US personnel embedded in the various departments of Bletchley, and they take over their own bomb machines and everything else. So that's a big step forward in the relationship.
And you and Erica looked into this in detail back in October 2018 in episode 79.
Autumn 1943, the British and the Americans invaded separately in Italy. Would you say that level of cooperation was reflected in the work that was happening at Bletchley Park?
Well, the story at Bletchley is quite different. While they might be struggling as allies a little bit in Italy, the integration between the US and the UK on the signal side is getting ever stronger. This is marked in June of 43 by an actual written agreement that was produced between the two countries, which is known by the guys who signed it as the Travis Strong Agreement. Travis, of course, being head of GCNCS at that point. It also gets referred to as Britain-USA or the BRUSA Agreement is sort of the acronym that it's got. What that did was it formally accepted Americans into all of the signals intelligence work that the British were doing. There had been American visitors to Bletchley previously, and we've covered in this podcast the famous Sinkoff visit in 1941, where four Americans came over and had a look around and went back to America again. In 1943, you get the first staff who come over permanently to be employed alongside everybody else at Bletchley, as if they were British, effectively, and completely absorbed into the organisation. And that follows on from this agreement in the summer of 43.
And that agreement was forged on site here at Bletchley Park?
It was negotiated in the US, mm-hmm. mostly. Travis went over to America and met all the relevant parties. Unfortunately, it would be nice if we could say, like with the Sinkoff visit, that it happened here, because those Americans were actually in Denison's office in the mansion, and you can go in there and see where they all met. The later agreements in 1943, it's harder to sort of pin them down. That was Travis's office at that point, but as I understand it, the agreement was actually signed in the United States, in Washington, D.C.
So these initial Americans that came over to Bletchley Park, what were they doing?
Well, they get distributed into different bits of the Bletchley organisation. A group of them go into SIXTA, which is the traffic analysis section, and some go to Hut 6 and to Block F, where they're doing Fish-Lorentz work.
Were they working alongside Bletchley Park staff as well, or were they quite clearly identified as US personnel?
They were pretty much integrated. You hear about the fact that some sections might have an American sergeant commanding or managing British personnel, and in another room, the reverse might be true, it might be a Brit looking after Americans. So they're really quite embedded in that way.
Sounds like a close working relationship began right from the start of them coming over here.
Very much so. And there's a report that was written after the war by the Americans giving an account of this. And one of the things it emphasises throughout is just how welcome they felt and how easily they were able to sort of slip into the organisation and to do their bit without sort of standing out, really.
So were the US personnel contributing to the British effort, or were they then communicating back to the States and the effort became much wider and international kind of working partnership?
Well, as we talked previously, Ultra starts to get sent to Patton in Sicily in July 43, and that continues. And the senior headquarters in the Italian campaign, Mark Clark, who's the American US Fifth Army commander, the British General Alexander, they all get Ultra on the same basis, without distinction of nationality. And what that means is not only do you have Brits and Americans receiving the intelligence out in the field more or less equally, it's actually being created more or less equally at Bletchley by Americans and Brits working alongside one another. The Americans are never, they're never more than a couple of percent of the number of people at Bletchley. I mean, you're talking tens of Americans surrounded by thousands of British. So they're a small group, but their presence is more significant than their numbers, if you know what I mean. Although there's only a few of them, it represents a much bigger collaborative relationship.
And was that the case till the end of the war, that there were only a handful of US personnel on site at Bletchley Park?
The numbers grow in 1944, and actually they bring over more Americans and they formalise their activities. And actually they create three formal American units within the UK, signal security detachments, they're called. One of those, 6812 security detachment, runs bomb machines, and they go down to Eastcote, to the bomb outstation at Eastcote. And they're given a complete bay of 10 bomb machines to run for themselves. It was called USA Bay. All of the American machines were named after cities, and they actually had signs hanging on them with the city names on. And we're lucky that two of those signs survive, for Houston and Washington. And those two signs are in our Hut 11A exhibition.
That's true. They've actually been illustrated with images of the states as well, haven't they? So it feels a little bit like a taste of home on those signs.
Yes, they've got kind of pen and ink drawings of local landmarks from both cities around the lettering.
So they really made that bay their own.
Oh, very much so, yes. There are two other detachments that are sent. 6813 detachment takes over the people who are here at Bletchley Park. Previously, they'd been billeted around Bletchley, but at that point, they get their own kind of headquarters, and they take over the manor house in Little Brick Hill, which is a village about 5 miles from Bletchley down towards Woburn. And so they had a country house down there, and they had their own kind of administration team who looked after them down there, and then they would have been bussed in every day. The third detachment, 6811 detachment, are down in Kent at Bexley, and they run a Y station. So they're involved in the interception process as well. So you've got Americans doing the interception, you've got Americans at Bletchley doing things like traffic analysis and working in Hut 6, you've got Americans running half the bomb out station. And so they're really in every level of the process. And then, of course, their own SLUs and recipients out on the battlefield.
So fully integrated into what Bletchley Park was running.
Completely integrated into what Bletchley Park's doing.
Asa Briggs from Hut 6 visited Little Brick Hill, and he visited the Americans there. And in his memoirs, he actually mentions that it was at Little Brick Hill that he ate his first avocados, tasted his first American coffee, and drank his first bourbon and first dry martini. He claims he was never the same again.
That's not untypical. You hear the same from the Wrens who went to US Air Force bases, that they were exposed to foods and to, you know, they'd go and listen to Glenn Miller, for example. There was all sorts of American influences coming into the country.
What about meals?
Don't talk about meals. It's not a nice subject at all. No, meals were a bit of a problem. They were all right at the Abbey, reasonably all right. But, you know, you need to be tempted when you're on night shift and, you know, tired out. And I think I existed on cornflakes. I still like cornflakes. I didn't know what else to eat. It wasn't very good at all. They didn't pander to us in that respect. I remember when quite a few Americans arrived, breakfast improved a bit because we always had marmalade or honey something with bacon on the plate. You know, they put it all on the plate. And the Americans always like something sweet, whatever they call them, pancakes. And they got them, so we got them. They didn't come up very often, I don't think, but it was possible that you might be on duty when they were doing them.
The thing that's also slightly weird about this is you think, why are the Americans importing avocados in the middle of a war? Because you have to imagine those avocados have come across in a convoy through the U-boats in the Atlantic, and it seems a little frivolous to be importing avocados. But something the Americans still do with their military today, but they particularly did in the Second World War, was they felt that soldiers serving overseas should, as far as possible, have all the comforts that they had back in the USA. So all sorts of things that we would think of as quite trivial were imported for the US military to keep the morale up and to make them feel that they were still valued by the government and their service was really appreciated. It's quite a contrast to British soldiers serving overseas who got very basic rations, and if they got anything special, it was because somebody at home had posted it to them. So, you know, there's a reason the army in Burma call themselves a forgotten army. They feel no one's really noticing them. This is contrast with the Americans who are getting, for example, bourbon and avocados delivered. And the British people at Bletchley in particular would have found that quite striking.
And there was an American aerodrome, and they used to put notices on the board. 40 wrens wanted,
for a dance, put your name up. And I used to say, well, I'm not going. I was a bit of a prude in those days. Anyway, I did go. Because they said, oh, come, Pam, lovely food. It's lots and lots. And I did have lovely food. And they were so well looked after, the American. Like, that was something to do with Bletchley Park. But as opposed to our poor old privates, they had lovely uniform, wonderful food. They had proper bands. We had Glenn Miller there. You know, it wasn't an old sort of dance like you'd have in the city in the church hall or something. And great music and wonderful food.
So this bus that took the 40 wrens, would that go to an aerodrome?
No, they'd send a lorry for us.
Lorry?
We have to climb up on the tailboard in uniform. Not easy. All these people whistling at us.
It's something that we do hear again and again about the Americans coming over here, about the impact on not even just military personnel, but on British society in general with the Americans coming over here. But it's interesting to see that that went as far as Bletchley. Even people working at Bletchley Park were being impacted on a personal level by meeting Americans, by spending time with them.
And the other thing you have to remember is nowadays, we all watch American television on a daily basis. We follow their politics. The two countries are culturally much, much closer together. In the 1940s, people would have watched a Hollywood movie when they went to the cinema on a Saturday afternoon, and they would have been familiar with American cliches like kind of cowboys and things like that. But in terms of day-to-day culture and normal life in America, as opposed to, you know, the life in the movies, that was a completely foreign country at that time. And so Americans would have seemed to British people a lot more strange and unusual than they do today. Mm. And it's really the first time that that sort of cultural relationship starts to really develop. It's manifested at Bletchley by the fact that some of the Americans who come here actually get married to British people. I mean, Barbara Abernathy famously welcomed the first Americans in 1941, ends up marrying Joe Ekus, who is one of the Americans who serves here. And she wasn't the only one.
In our oral history archive, there are some wonderful stories of wrens who are obviously young women, very young in some situations. They're in their late teens, their first time away from home. And they're talking about experiencing ice cream and chocolate and quite wholesome things, actually. But during wartime, obviously, quite a rarity. And the treat of being able to spend time with the Americans dancing and eating ice cream during what must have been quite a topsy-turvy time for them in their lives as well, away from home and while there's a war on. So it is extremely interesting to see this progression, this development of their experiences, not just the negative side, not just the awful elements of the war, but by meeting the Americans, this positive experience that they had.
And also there were dances. I love to go to the American dances because the American dances, we used to have ice cream. This sounds so ridiculous. You would get, I mean, whereas the English during the war, we couldn't have ice cream. But actually, Americans, they didn't go for me. They'd always say, oh, you remind me of my granddaughter. So that I always had plenty of people to dance with, but they were looking on me as their granddaughter.
We've been talking about the Americans over here. What about over there?
Well, by 1943, the GCNCS and the Signals Intelligence Corporation stretches right across the Atlantic because we've talked about the bomb machines at Eastcote and the Americans operating the bomb machines down there. The American Navy also built bomb machines of its own. And the first of those comes into use in August of 1943. This is a program, again, that had begun earlier with the transatlantic agreements, the Travis Strong Agreement and other previous agreements. The Americans had been pressing for a long time to be basically told how the bombs worked and introduced into all that technology. Bletchley initially is a bit reluctant to do that because they don't particularly want to share the technology. Also, the simplest way to do it would have been to put a bomb on a ship and send it across. But the machines are in high demand, and also they don't want really to take the security gamble of trying to move one. However, in late 42, they decide that they really need to get on with this. And in fact, the American scientists come up with a concept for a bomb of their own. It's by no means a copy of the British one. It's actually a more efficient machine working on slightly different principles.
So the American bomb is of a different design to the British bomb?
It is. The major difference that's significant in terms of its work is from the outset, they build a four-rotor machine. Most of the British bombs were three-rotor machines, but from 1942, U-boats are using this M4, the four-rotor Enigma machine, and to break that efficiently, you need an equivalent four-rotor bomb machine. And the British had experimented with a number of different solutions to that problem, and they start building their own four-rotor bomb machines. But the US Navy version is a four-rotor machine from the start. And so what that allows them to do is to, by late 1943 into 44, take over almost entirely the breaking of U-boat traffic. It's still managed from Bletchley, but the menus are sent to Washington and the keys are established in Washington and then it comes back. So again, it's a really integrated process. It's not a whole separate setup. It's kind of absorbed within the Bletchley operation, but it is quite distinct in that they're all four-rotor machines. The task is initially allocated to the National Cash Register Company, who are based in Dayton, Ohio. And once a design has been produced, NCR are tasked with the actual manufacture of this thing under an American engineer called Joe Desch, who takes over the work. A number of people visit him at various times. He lived in a small two-bedroom house on the NCR site in Dayton. And the process was supervised by an American naval officer who was living in Joe Desch's guest bedroom. So it meant that if any British people turned up, there were no beds left. And so people who go sleep on the floor at Joe Desch's house while advising them on producing the machines.
Right from the start, were the American bombs operated at Dayton, Ohio, or were they transported elsewhere?
The intention is to run them in Washington, D.C., because that's where the headquarters of the U.S. Navy is and where a lot of the other intelligence agencies are. So they take over an old girls' school, the Mount Vernon Seminary in suburban Washington, and that is converted to accept bomb machines, and they build a new building there, a purpose-built structure to take these machines. The problem is that the first machines are up and running in May of 1943 before the building's finished. So initially, they start running the machines in Dayton, and as they come off the production line, they kind of store them in corridors and odd corners around the factory, and they start code-breaking on them in Dayton. But as soon as they can, they start shipping them to Washington, and they build this formal sort of bomb-out station, if you like. The work there mirrors the outstations in the UK in the sense that all the machines are run by female naval personnel. The American equivalent of a WREN is a woman accepted for voluntary emergency service. The acronym is WAVES. So a WAVE was the American equivalent of a WREN. And something like 700 of these women were employed by the end of the war running bombs in Washington, D.C. Again, it was quite a similar experience. They were billeted in a sort of barrack block very near to the bomb out station. And all the same security and secrecy constraints were applied to them. There's accounts of one lady basically being told, if you ever speak of this again, we'll shoot you, which is, you know, when you're a 19-year-old woman, must have been a pretty terrifying concept. And so that operation grows until by the end of the war, they have roughly 100 bomb machines running, and they are able to deal with all of the U-boat traffic that the Allies need to process. And quite often in any one 24-hour period, they've done everything they need to do with U-boats, so they're able to be sent other three-rotor traffic, which they can also process. So it's a highly efficient and really massive contribution to the bomb effort. By the end of the war, you have to think there are 200 machines, roughly, run by Bletchley Park in the UK and 100 in the US. So it's a third of the output, basically, is coming from these WAVES.
Would a WAVES experience of operating a bomb be quite similar to a WREN's experience of operating a British bomb?
The exact tasks they'd be doing on the machine are slightly different, but in terms of the shifts and the secrecy and the working conditions, in terms of being in a large hall full of machines producing an enormous amount of heat, it would have been a very similar experience. In fact, one of the things they have to do when they build the building, Washington in the summer is a very hot place, just the weather is very warm. And so they had huge numbers of air conditioners. Americans are much more used to air conditioning in the 1940s than Britain. An air conditioning machine at Bletchley would have been considered as a, you know, something from outer space. And the Americans had them by the dozen, and they fitted them to the building by the dozen. Every other window had an aircon unit on it to try and cool the place down. But again, if you have 100 of these machines all, you know, using huge amounts of electricity and clanking away, it would have been a hot place to work.
So again, naval female personnel operating and setting up the bombs, and then men who were doing the repair work on them?
Yes, in the same way as the British have RAF technicians, the US used male technicians to maintain the machines. there is still that kind of sexual divide that women are considered able to operate machinery, but not to mend machinery.
Was it just the US Navy who were running the bomb operation in the States?
No, the US Army did try and get involved as well. One of the issues throughout the war that Bletchley faces is that the US Navy and the US War Department, the Army, don't communicate very well. They're rivals. And particularly on the intelligence side, they don't like sharing with each other very much. And Bletchley tended to have to negotiate with the one and then negotiate with the other. So once the Navy have a bomb operation going, the US Army developed their own operation. In the end, they built one bomb, which they christened Madame X. It was actually extraordinarily expensive to build, and it was quite an ambitious machine. It was intended to replicate 144 Enigma machines, as opposed to the 36 on a British machine. So it was a very ambitious device, but it relied on relays and on old telephone technology, which made it quite slow. And they never built more than one. It never really went into full-time production or operation.
Did it look like the US Navy bombs?
Not really. We have an image of it, and it consisted of a whole series of racks of electronics, which it looks like a series of bookshelves with sort of 3-foot gaps in between them. It would have occupied a whole room. The reason they had so many Enigmas on it was the idea that you didn't have to take rotor wheels off and on if you wanted to change the rotor order. You could do all that electronically, but it made it a very cumbersome device. And actually, they spent more than $1 million building one machine. And if you think the US Navy spent $6 million building 100 machines, you can see that it wasn't really a very useful prospect. It stayed running until the end of the war, and Bletchley would send experimental menus of different kinds to it, and they did various sort of projects, if you like, research projects on it. But it was never used for day-to-day code breaking.
From the cooperation that we've seen between the Allies in Italy, right through to the integrated coordinated working that we've talked about with the bomb operation and with the code-breaking work that was taking place with Americans coming to Bletchley Park and the communication across the Atlantic, would you say 1943 was then a turning point?
It's definitely a milestone in the evolution of the relationship between the two countries. And you're not only seeing industrialised signals intelligence going on in the UK at Bletchley, you're now seeing it going on in Washington as well. And we have to remember, against the background of this, there's also all the work that the Americans are doing on Japanese codes and ciphers, which we haven't talked about so much, but that is equally important. And although they're taking the lead on some of that, that's being shared back with the British. So the Anglo-American relationship is becoming more and more seamless. And even if they're not completely seeing eye to eye about strategy in Italy, they will, as time goes on, get closer and closer together as allies. By the time we get to 6th of June 1944, these two countries and their signals intelligence operations are completely welded together as one.
Now, it wasn't all one-way traffic with Americans coming to Britain. There was actually some British staff who went over to Washington.
Yes. On a number of occasions, British GCNCS personnel go to the US, and this happens right from kind of 1941 onwards. Key moments are 1943, when Alan Turing visits to advise the Americans on their bomb machines. John Tiltman travels to the US on a number of occasions. Frank Birch goes, Travis goes, Harry Hinsley goes. So all sorts of different British personnel make their way to Washington at various points. And in particular, in 1945, a number of personnel go over to Washington, and they're not all senior staff either.
My most interesting job was when I was transferred to the Japanese section to do paraphrasing of translated Japanese messages. It had been deciphered and translated, so what I saw was English, but it was mostly from the Burmese border with India.
And the purpose of you providing these paraphrasings, what was that all about?
Well, that was so that they could be transferred to our military personnel in Burma in disguise.
When the war finished in Europe, your paraphrasing of Japanese messages continued, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it did. It was a complete surprise because a number of us, myself included, were due to go to Delhi. Anyway, suddenly that whole exercise was cancelled, and I was chosen out of I suppose quite a few others, and I don't know why, but my boss called me in and said, sorry you're not going to Delhi, but you are going to Washington to work in the Pentagon with the British community there. A very, very large building, the like of which I'd never seen before, and I was taken down by my English boss from the Cairo Hotel in Washington where we were accommodated, and we went down by bus, and we were taken into Colonel O'Connor's office. He was the American colonel in charge of that particular department, and then I was put to work doing my paraphrasing again.
Am I right that there was around 30,000 people working there?
Absolutely right. 32,000 for lunch.
Everything must have been on an enormous scale.
Indeed it was, and the Pentagon is enormous, absolutely enormous. Even the centrepiece, I believe I'm right in saying it was something like 8 acres. And when General Eisenhower had finished his duties in Europe, he came back to America and came to see us in the Pentagon in this quadrangle. He came in a tank with an entourage of soldiers and other vehicles, and we were able to see him at close quarters.
You know, we hear stories about how cold it was at Bletchley, sort of working in the huts and things, and it must have been quite different sort of working in Washington, Washington at that sort of time.
That's right. Washington in the summer could be very, very hot indeed, and with a very high rate of humidity. So we didn't wear our khaki uniforms. We were issued with the Canadian summer uniform, which relieved the situation a bit. But in those days, we're talking about the 40s, very few buildings had air conditioning. The Pentagon did, but actually that was quite a shock to the body. As you went in, you felt the sudden blast of cold, which was almost as bad as a blast of hot air. But you get used to that sort of thing.
When did you come back?
We couldn't get a passage back until October, but the atomic bomb was dropped. But anyway, that was the end of the war, of course. But we had to wait for transport home. So it was early October before I finally left Washington for New York, where we had to wait about for the Aquitania. And I spent 3 very wet days in New York waiting to get on the boat.
But I bet you were able to bring a few things back that you couldn't get in
England. Oh, absolutely. I mean, shopping in Washington and New York after the privations of England were absolutely wonderful. We were able to buy clothes and anything else we wanted, really.
So you were a bit loaded down when you came back?
Absolutely loaded down. I had 2 kit bags and 2 other cases which I'd bought. And because the stevedores were on strike, I had to carry the lot. So it was 1 under each arm and 1 in each hand. Yeah, but it was a very rough crossing, actually. Very rough indeed, and it took about 4 days to get back to England.
So you came back to Bletchley after you were in Washington?
Yes, that's right, but only very briefly. And, of course, it was all being run down.
So it would have been a very different atmosphere at that point.
Oh, a very different atmosphere. Rather, you know, sort of the end of a party atmosphere. There was nothing much to be done, apart from those who'd been given the job of destroying everything. So I was only there for a few days, and I was posted down to wait for my demob.
I guess the best example of how the special relationship was thought of would be the Eisenhower letter that we had on display at Bletchley Park for quite a while.
We did indeed. And the Eisenhower letter kind of ends a chapter because Eisenhower is specifically talking about the contribution that GC&CS made to the Second World War, and in particular the defeat of Germany, which was the part of the war that he was responsible for. However, as Eisenhower is congratulating GC&CS on the successes during the war, a number of minds on both sides of the Atlantic are turning towards peace and the Cold War and how signals intelligence will continue into the future.
Let's go back to episode 45 when we looked in depth at the Eisenhower letter.
Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, Office of the Supreme Commander. 12 July 1945. Dear General Menges, I had hoped to be able to pay a visit to Bletchley Park in order to thank you, Sir Edward Travis, and the members of the staff personally for the magnificent services which have been rendered to the Allied cause. I am very well aware of the immense amount of work and effort which has been involved in the production of the material with which you have supplied us. I fully realize also the numerous setbacks and difficulties with which you have had to contend, and how you have always, by your supreme efforts, overcome them. The intelligence which has emanated from you before and during this campaign has been of priceless value to me. It has simplified my task as a commander enormously. It has saved thousands of British and American lives, and in no small way contributed to the speed with which the enemy was routed and eventually forced to surrender. I should be very grateful, therefore, if you would express to each and every one of those engaged in this work my heartfelt admiration and sincere thanks for their decisive contribution to the Allied war effort. Sincerely, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. This letter represents the opinion of the five-star general who has led the Allied armies in the West against the Nazis, that the intelligence produced at Bletchley Park was an integral part of their campaign, or what Eisenhower called a crusade, against tyranny. It represents Eisenhower's recognition of the joint effort of American and British cryptologists in providing the information that resulted in wise decisions that were used to defeat Nazi leaders in battle. I think this letter represents a turning point in the life of Dwight Eisenhower, certainly, but perhaps the life of America as well, the life of the American and British relationship. Before World War II, no American officer had education or experience in intelligence, none that reached senior level anyway. Eisenhower had to be taught how to use intelligence, had to be taught, in fact, what it was. His intelligence officer, a British general, Major General Strong, taught him well on how to use intelligence in his decision-making process, and it served the Allied armies well in reducing casualties and shortening the time of war. This letter is Eisenhower's acknowledgement that this had happened, its importance in individual lives and the lives of the two countries. But the letter also has a second significance. Within 5 years after it had been written, Eisenhower was appointed the first commanding general of NATO. Within 2 years after that, he was elected president of the United States. In both positions, he was an astute user of intelligence in his decision-making, and he was so knowledgeable he could make improvements to the way intelligence was done. It all traces back to the time at Bletchley Park that this letter represents. Written in July 1945, it talks about the period from 1940 to 1945, but its significance resonates down to today. This letter has the ring of Dwight Eisenhower in it. I can't prove that no staffer touched the wording, but Eisenhower himself was a good writer, and he was sincere in what he would write as official documents. They were not just standardized forms to him. So I think there's a good chance that most, if not all, of this letter was Eisenhower's words himself. I believe it would probably also have been his decision that such a letter had to be written. We don't have the details, and I can't prove it, but it very much sounds like Eisenhower, who was not only a strategic thinker, but somebody who took care of his people. I've researched many original documents on Eisenhower's use of intelligence and use of SIGINT, and I believe that his knowledge of and his ability to use SIGINT and other intelligence materials in his presidency and in his commandership of NATO traces back to what he learned during the war itself, which traces back to much of the material that he received from Bletchley Park.
People might look at what is really just one 75-year-old piece of paper in a glass case and think, what's so important about that?
That piece of paper is vitally important to us because it is proof of the significance and importance of the work that was done here during the war. We could have put up a panel saying, we think this work is very important, and that would be fair enough, but in the case of this letter, we have a firm opinion by someone who was there at the time and who was in charge of the whole thing, Eisenhower, as head of the Allied Expeditionary Force, saying what Bletchley did was absolutely vital. Of priceless value is the phrase he uses. So we don't need to say it because he said it for us.
It also goes back to the fact that it was never a foregone conclusion that we were going to win World War II, was it?
Absolutely not. There's a perception nowadays that the Allies were always going to win in the Second World War, that we had a predominance of kit and equipment, men. Eisenhower himself is very worried that, for example, the D-Day landings might fail. He had a speech written, prepared for that evening to go on the radio to apologise to people in case the operation was a disaster. So he was aware that it was a very closely contested thing. And so for him, anything that gave him an advantage over the Germans was absolutely crucial. And of course, the signals intelligence from Bletchley is a massive part of that. He has a very full understanding of where the Germans are, what equipment they've got, what their plans are. And that is vital to him for fighting the battle. Not only in knowing what the Germans are doing on the battlefield before the invasion, but also in understanding what they're anticipating, where they think the invasion is going to happen. And part of that is famously the Double Cross operation and Operation Fortitude, where intelligence is being deliberately fed to the Germans, misinformation about a potential invasion in Calais. And one of the things Bletchley Park is able to do is listen to various forms of German internal communications, which show that they've swallowed the bait. We're able to say with some confidence that Hitler still believes the invasion will be in Calais. And of course, so long as he thinks it's going to happen in Calais, he keeps troops there rather than in Normandy, and that helps the men on the beach to succeed.
And there's something really special about this piece of paper, isn't it? It just sings of history, doesn't it? The number of staples that have been in the corner, and seeing it really brings everything home, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a piece of paper that is of vital historical importance to us and to the Second World War in general. But what's interesting about it is it has clearly not always been that, because it's got holes in the corner where it was safety pinned to things. It's got punch holes down the side from where it was put in a ring binder. It's now in a case, beautifully temperature controlled and managed, and we treat it like the priceless object it is. But that clearly hasn't always been the case.
Tony, you must see so many historical documents in your job, but is this a little bit more special than some of the others?
It is, and I think there are two reasons why. Firstly, it's Eisenhower himself, the Supreme Allied Commander, saying what the contribution of Bletchley Park has been during the war. I think it's interesting that where some academic historians in the latter part of the 20th century talked about, oh, it took 2 years off the war and things like that, I think Eisenhower's judgment that it hastened the German rout and it saved thousands of Allied lives is really interesting, partly because he humanises the value of the intelligence into the number of lives saved. But I think also because it reminds us that all of the work at Bletchley Park, all the tremendous intellectual work that went into cryptanalysis, is fundamentally only happening because there's a customer who needs that information. What Bletchley Park enabled General Eisenhower to do was have, in a very 21st century expression, complete information dominance. He knew what the Germans were doing. The Germans didn't know what he was doing. There's a real reminder to people who work in intelligence that the people that we are providing intelligence for are the people who are really doing the difficult and dangerous work. And our job is to help make that as easy as possible for them. The other point that I take from the letter is one that Eisenhower doesn't spell out. But he's an American general who's commanding British and American forces. Bletchley Park, by the end of the war, had hundreds of Americans who were integrated into the work of the organisation. And I think it's really important to realise that that level of integration between the UK and the US, both at the military level and at the intelligence level, was something that started here. Started in February 1941, but by VE Day, by the time Eisenhower's writing this letter, the integration is so complete that it's not even something that he feels that he needs to highlight.
And it's something that we still benefit from even today, isn't it?
We do, because of course, what had happened during the war, the governments in the two countries decided that it would be a good idea to carry that on in peacetime. And both at the intelligence level, the formal agreement between the UK and the US to continue intelligence cooperation was signed early in 1946. But we also see through NATO the fact that the US didn't abandon Europe, it stayed in Europe, and that the alliance that had begun during the Second World War continues to this day.
You said earlier the Eisenhower letter was really the end of one chapter and we're about to go into a new one. So what happens at the end of the war? I mean, is it a given that we will carry on with this relationship?
It is and it isn't, in the sense that on both sides of the Atlantic, there is a perception, certainly in sort of government circles, that sharing things with one's allies is no longer really required, and that the British and the British Empire can go back to pre-war business as usual, and that the United States can go back to being the quite isolationist country it was in the 1930s. And so at that level, both sides would be happy to say kind of thank you and good night. But at the lower level, at the technical level, the people actually working in GCCS or in Op-20G in America, the people who are doing the code breaking know that this problem isn't going to go away. And particularly with the breaking down of the relationship with Stalin and the Soviet Union, you know, the Cold War is looming. And on both sides, they're very keen to stay technically up to date. There's a worry that if they stop collaborating, you know, one of them might develop ideas that the other one hasn't thought of. And particularly in the United States, having used nuclear weapons themselves, the fear is that someone else could attack them with nuclear weapons. And the first thing they'd know about it was when a city blew up. This term, a nuclear Pearl Harbor, is bandied about. And so at the technical level, they're very concerned to gain as much SIGINT and code-breaking knowledge as they can. And obviously, finding out what everyone else is achieving is really vital to that. So at the technical level, they're still very keen to keep sharing with the British.
What about at the political level, though?
Well, as I say, at the political level, particularly in the United States, there is a sense that if it were popularly known that the US was still sharing all its secrets with the British, a lot of questions would be asked. A lot of politicians would say, why are we still doing this? Isn't the war finished? You know, can't we go back to being the US on its own? And so there's a kind of a mismatch. And in fact, President Truman takes the attitude that he's happy to sanction further collaboration, but he kind of doesn't want to know anything about it. He more or less says to his people, you can make an agreement with the British, but it has to be secret, and we can't have a formal treaty that is a sort of public document sanctioned by Congress and everything else. This all has to be done under the radar and kept very on the down low.
Plausible deniability.
Exactly. And the British, it's the same. I mean, the British in 1945, the attitude to intelligence and signals intelligence in particular is very much one of, even though we've done very well, you know, against Enigma or whatever, there's absolutely no reason to tell anybody about any of that or make any of it public.
No.
And as we know, the whole thing was kept very, very secret for a long time afterwards.
This decision's been made that, yes, they can carry on talking to each other. So what steps are taken for this to happen?
Well, both sides know, and the British know in particular, that these kinds of negotiations are not straightforward. And it's taken 5 years to get an effective working relationship with the United States, particularly over Japanese code-breaking, because since Brewster in 43, that didn't solve everything. It wasn't until the Japanese were very nearly defeated in late 1945 that the agreements and the procedures that they put in place finally started to work. So they know it's not going to be a straightforward thing, but they're eager to crack on. So as early as May 1945, almost as soon as the Germans have surrendered, Eric Jones, we've talked about him on the podcast before, as the head of Hut 3. Obviously, once Enigma stops, Hut 3 is kind of out of a job. So Eric Jones is available, and he was sent as a liaison officer to Washington. But one of the reasons he's sent is because he hasn't had anything to do with Japanese work before, and he hasn't been part of the controversy that's been brewing over that for the last few years. So he's kind of a neutral character in that sense. And he goes out straight away in May and starts talking to people. And he is followed by a delegation of Harry Hinsley from Naval Section, Edward Travis, who is director of GCNCS by that point, and John Tiltman, a very senior codebreaker. And there's actually a rather nice colour photograph of the three of them on a lawn somewhere in the United States, taken in November 1945, when they were out there negotiating.
GCNCS are really sending over the heavy mob, aren't they, really?
They are in a way, but what's interesting is a lot of the negotiation is led by Hinsley. And he's still in his 20s at this point, and he's the man who drafts the first version of the agreement. He produces a draft on the 1st of November 1945. And it's clear that the British are trying not to go in too heavy, if you like. They're trying to keep it friendly and keep it on the kind of the professional technical level rather than on the senior director slash political kind of level. And so Hinsley, even though he might appear quite junior, is a key player.
Top secret. British and US Communication Intelligence Agreement, 5th of March, 1946. Outline of British and US Communication Intelligence Agreement. Number 1. Parties to the agreement. Number 2. Scope of the agreement. Number 3. Extent of the agreement. Products. Number 4. Extent of the agreement. Methods and techniques. Number 5. Third parties to the agreement. Number 6. The Dominions. Number 7. Channels between US and the British Empire agencies. Number 8. Dissemination and security. Number 9. Dissemination and security. Commercial. Number 10. Previous agreements. Number 11. Amendment and termination of agreement. Number 12. Activation and implementation.
What's in this draft agreement that Hinsley comes up with?
Well, the principles of it can be set up fairly straightforwardly as it was an agreement to share almost everything with each other and to promise not to share anything with anybody else. Intelligence sharing is one thing, but the promise to not intelligence share with others is equally important in a way, because if the British are talking freely to the Americans, they need to know that whatever they share with the Americans will not go any further. And so keeping it in-house is as important as the sharing. The agreement itself stretches across all aspects of SIGINT. I can read the list from Hinsley's original agreement.
Yeah.
There's collection of traffic, which is, you know, Y stations, monitoring information, acquisition of communication documents and equipment, so pinching, stealing stuff, traffic analysis, crypt analysis, decryption and translation, and acquisition of information regarding communications organizations, practices, procedures, and equipment. So that's basically all aspects of SIGINT. The only reason the two parties are kind of permitted to not share stuff is if they think it would have a significant impact on their own ability to communicate privately. So you don't have to tell the other side how your own ciphers work necessarily, but you have to share everything about what you found out about other people's.
I guess that includes promising not to read each other's messages then.
Essentially, yes. That part of it is kind of unspoken, but it is in there. The assumption that you will not seek to attack the other person's communications, that is actually specified in further clauses of the agreements, that each other's communications are sacrosanct.
Yeah.
Because the Americans are painfully aware that throughout the 1930s, basically, GCNCS was able to read State Department communications, and they've got a bit burnt by that, and their big concern is that the British will spy on them, essentially.
Well, we'd been doing it since 1917, hadn't we?
We had form in that department. Yeah. Certainly, you know, it had been done.
So that sounds quite straightforward. Was that it then? It was signed, all fine, everyone was happy with it?
Well, no, it took a while to negotiate all the detail. I mean, if you compare the agreement that Hinsley drafted in November with the 6 points that I described to you earlier, it's actually quite a short document. But the agreement that's finally signed on 5th of March 1946 is substantially longer. And most of that extra length is technical appendices at the end where people have had to sit down and say, it's all very well saying, we'll collaborate on traffic analysis, but what does that mean in practice? What are the bounds of it? How do you define it? Et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of sort of technical appendices that make the agreement a lot longer and properly get into the nitty gritty of what it actually means. Because I think they knew that for it to be robust and for it to last, because they're not signing it sort of till they defeat Germany or till they defeat Japan or something, they're signing it kind of forever and ever. And so you need to know what you think it means. Both sides need to be completely happy with the content. So it does take a lot of nitty-gritty negotiation just to make sure that everybody's completely happy with what it's saying and it's completely transparent what it's saying for everybody everywhere.
Did they have any sticking points in those negotiations?
There was one that came up, and I was looking at a document about this just today in our archive, in fact. Canada, obviously, is a Crown Dominion. The Queen's still on the money in Canada, but also they're the immediate next-door neighbours of the US. And as the agreement was first laid out, it was agreed, or it's proposed, that all of the Dominions that had been collaborating on SIGINT during the Second World War, so Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, all of these places would be represented essentially by GCNCS. And that if they wanted to talk to the Americans, that would go through London. And if the Americans wanted to talk to them, that would go back through London. And that seemed perfectly logical to the British. You know, Britain is the head of the Dominions, etc. But the Americans took a different view. They said, no, the Canadians are immediate next door neighbours. We've been collaborating with them on SIGINT very closely during the war. And even before the war, they were collaborating on smuggling during Prohibition and things like that. So they have a very close relationship with the Canadians. So they say, we'd like to talk to the Canadians direct. And the paperwork talks about this triangle of UK, US, Canada, and how the three sides of the triangle should be controlled. And eventually it's agreed that Canada and the US should be allowed to talk to each other quite happily, but that Canada should tell the British before they talk to the Americans, and that the Americans should tell the British before they talk to the Canadians, just to kind of keep them in the loop. It says that this should not be done as a fait accompli, is what it says in the document. It's no good telling the British 2 weeks later that you've been discussing something. You know, it needs to be contemporary. But they do figure it out. And in fact, although Canada is not a direct signatory to the first agreement, in 1948, so only 2 years later, the agreement is formally extended to Canada, and they become a sort of a third member of the club in their own right.
Number one, parties to the agreement. The following agreement is made between the State Army Navy Communication Intelligence Board, STEN-CIB, representing the US State, Navy and War Departments, and all other US communication intelligence authorities which may function, and the London Signal Intelligence, SIGINT Board, representing the Foreign Office, Admiralty, War Office, Air Ministry, and all other British Empire communication intelligence authorities which may function. Number 2. Scope of the agreement. The agreement governs the relations of the above-mentioned parties in communications intelligence matters only. However, the exchange of such collateral material as is applicable for technical purposes and is not prejudicial to national interests will be effected between the communication intelligence agencies of both countries. Number 3. Extent of the agreement. Products. Point A. The parties agree to the exchange of products of the following operations relating to foreign communications.
So the actual Brewster Agreement, that's finally signed when?
The actual Brewster Agreement is signed in London.
Sorry, I'm saying Brewster, it's not Brewster, is it?
Well, this is the thing. It is Brewster when it's signed.
Okay.
We refer to it now as the UK-USA Agreement, but the original agreement signed on 5th of March 1946 in London was Britain-USA again. It was Brewster again, and it's known as the 1946 Brewster Agreement. It was only in 1954 that the British requested that the acronym be changed, and UK-USA was substituted as the name for it, presumably to avoid confusion with earlier agreements. I don't know.
And it's actually signed in London, did you say?
Yes. The British delegation had gone to Washington in November 1945 and been there for a month or two, but then the final negotiations and the final signing took place in London in March of 1946. And it's signed on the British side by a chap called Patrick Marr Johnson, and he represents an organisation called the London Signals Intelligence Board. And the London Signals Intelligence Board is essentially GCNCS, but it also is an umbrella to cover the War Office, the Admiralty, the Foreign Office, the other government departments that might have an interest in what's going on. And similarly, the US signatory is a US general called Hoyt Vandenberg, and he signs on behalf of an outfit called the SANCIB, the State Army Navy Communications Intelligence Board. And that is basically the signals intelligence agencies of the US Army, the US Navy, and the State Department. So it's kind of the same group of organizations as the London Signals Intelligence Board represents for the UK. What makes this interesting, actually, is all of the previous agreements that have been signed during the war were either signed with the War Department or with the Navy in America, because the US Navy and the US War Department didn't really talk to each other during the war. So this is the first time that they both signed the same agreement with the British. So that's kind of a major step forward in its own right.
And also, people might wonder why there isn't a US Air Force in there. But at the time, the US Air Force came under the US Army, didn't it?
Yes. There are issues subsequently because the US Air Force tries to go its own way with SIGINT and set up its own operations on that. But fortunately for all concerned, they're kind of discouraged from that.
Now, you've already mentioned that there was another agreement signed in 1948 that brought Canada into it. Does this continue to where we are today?
It does. There are a number of extensions of the agreement Australia and New Zealand were formally signed in 1956. And that gives us a term that's become quite notorious in the last decade or so, which is the Five Eyes, which is UK, US, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. But other countries were also brought on board as what were called third parties to the agreement. And that included Norway in 1952, Denmark in 1954, and the West Germans in 1955. So you can see the shadow of NATO hanging over it, if you like. These are the Western alliance in the Cold War period. And so although they are third parties, if you like, they're not automatically entitled to have the information that the US and UK and the Dominions have got. They are involved in sharing where it's appropriate. But at the same time, all of this remains deeply secret. And what makes it work, the kind of the grease in the wheels, is whereas during World War II, you had Germany and Japan as obvious signals intelligence targets, and they were working to a common goal. The Cold War means that they have another common goal. And it's clear that most of the intelligence exchange that happens through Yakuza is against the Soviet threat and against the Chinese and the communist bloc. There are other areas where, for example, in the Middle East in the 1950s, you've got Suez, you've got the various Arab-Israeli conflicts. At that point, foreign policy between the USA and Britain diverged quite substantially because we had very different interests in the Middle East. And so a lot less sharing goes on in those areas than in the areas where there's an obvious common interest. So Yakuza kind of hangs on the Cold War and on the Soviet threat, really.
Either consider its interests best served by such action. Number 12, activation and implementation of agreement. This agreement becomes effective by signature of duly authorised representatives of the London SIGINT Board and Stan CIB. Thereafter, its implementation will be arranged between the communication intelligence authorities concerned, subject to the approval of the London SIGINT Board and Stan CIB. For, and in behalf of, the London Signal Intelligence Board, Patrick Mar Johnson, Colonel, British Army, General Staff. For, and in behalf of, the State Army Navy Communication Intelligence Board, Hoyt S. Vandenberg, Lieutenant General, GCS Senior Member.
Now, if this is the basis of the special relationship that we have today, how do we know about this?
Well, this is the thing. It remained secret for many, many years. And as we know, the Bletchley Park story, the wartime story, remained secret until the mid-1970s.
Mm.
And the mid-1970s is kind of a turning point because it's during that decade that GCHQ is first sort of publicly acknowledged. It's first avowed as existing by the government. The NSA in the USA is acknowledged at that point. CSEC, which is the Canadian operation, is acknowledged, and ASIC in Australia. They all become officially avowed by their national governments in the 1970s. So there's a great sort of unveiling of all sorts of secrets. And Yakuza is kind of in the mix at that point. Hints of it and the idea that there was this agreement in operation becomes public knowledge in the 1970s. And there's actually a bit of a scandal in Australia because it becomes apparent that the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation has been collaborating with the US on SIGINT, in particular from Pine Gap, which is their listening station in the middle of the Australian outback near Alice Springs. And this was without the knowledge of the Australian government. The Prime Minister of Australia at the time knew nothing about it.
No.
So it caused a certain amount of controversy in Australia.
Well, it brought down the government, didn't it?
It did, yes. And equally, GCHQ kind of got into the headlines first through sort of revelations in the 1970s. But then I remember in the 1980s when there were disputes about union representation at GCHQ, that GCHQ suddenly came into the limelight as well.
Mm.
So from the 1970s onwards, both the existence of all the participant organisations and the existence of an agreement between them became increasingly public knowledge. But it wasn't until relatively recently, it wasn't until 2010 that the British and the Americans formally said, yes, this agreement exists. And the NSA produced a redacted text of the original agreements. And now you can go on Google and you can Google Yakuza and it will take you to the NSA website and you can read most of the document. And you can read Hinsley's original draft.
You say most. There's one word missing. It's only one word that's been redacted.
The redactions seem a bit strange. You read it and you go, why is just that one word missing from an otherwise complete paragraph? You sit there speculating about what the word might be. What this means for me as a historian is since 2010, I can actually go there and I could read Hinsley's proposal and I can read the Finnish treaty, or most of it. And that's really exciting for me because it allows me to tell the final part of the World War II story, if you like, but also the first chapter of the ongoing story afterwards, which isn't really part of our Bletchley Park story, but obviously Bletchley Park is the birthplace of all of this, and its continuing relevance right up to today is why we care about Bletchley Park as well. So it's a very interesting story. And in some ways, since 2010, we've been able to see a little bit behind the curtain of how this agreement and these organisations have been protecting the Western powers, not only during the Cold War, but during the post 9/11 terrorist threats that we've had. All this work has been going on behind closed doors to protect the Western nations. And now we finally get a little sense of how people have gone about that.
There is deep sympathy and goodwill in Britain, and I doubt not here also towards the peoples of all the Russias, and a resolve to persevere through many differences and rebuffs in establishing lasting friendships. We understand the Russian need to be secure on our western frontier by the removal of all possibility of German aggression. We welcome Russia to our rightful place among the leading nations of the world. We welcome her flag upon the seas. Above all, we welcome, or should welcome, constant, frequent, and growing contacts between the Russian people and our own peoples on both sides of the Atlantic. It is my duty, however, for I am sure you would not wish me not to state the facts as I see them to you. It is my duty to place before you certain facts about the present position in Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all are subject, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.